This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. In the first hour today, we will be talking about the history of the CIA. And our guest is Tim Weiner. He's a reporter for The New York Times. He's written on American intelligence for 20 years and won the Pulitzer Prize for his work on secret national security programs. He is the author of a newly published book that is titled Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. It is published by Doubleday. It's out now in bookstores if you want to look at it, and indeed explores the history of the agency from its founding to the present. In the book, he points out that the CIA was created primarily for one purpose, and that was to gather and to analyze information. And in that, he says, it has failed. He says that the CIA has never truly fulfilled its main mission, informing the president of what was happening in the world. Instead, it has over time become a secret police force, and that was indeed the deepest fear of the people that created the agency. Mr. Weiner, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And yourself?
Weary, but well.
Well, I thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it. Let me just begin by asking a series of large and kind of general questions, and then perhaps we get into some specifics. Let me ask, if I ask you a question like this, if we look at the CIA as an intelligence-gathering agency, as something that basically was about doing research, gathering information, and then presenting that information to the president. How would you assess how well the CIA just performed that function?
There's a threefold mission in there. Hmm. One, to know the world, to know what's going on in the world. Two, to provide warning to prevent another Pearl Harbor. And three, to provide the president and the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State with the information that they need to plan and form a strategy for the United States as a superpower in the world, strategic intelligence, not for tomorrow, but for years, 2, 3, 4, 5 years out over the horizon. In each of these three missions, the CIA has not succeeded. It has not kept the president well and currently informed about the way of the world. And we have, you know, the staggering example of the Weapons of Mass Destruction report on Iraq in 2002 to cite as a recent example. It has not provided strategic warning. We suffered 3 Pearl Harbors in 2001 as a consequence. And it has not provided strategic intelligence. In fact, it hasn't done strategic intelligence for so long that hardly anybody there knows what it is anymore. It is caught up in dailiness, as newspapers are. What's happening right now? And we are also hammered by dailiness that we really can't see over the edge of our desks. That is not a good position for an intelligence service.
If then I ask another question, if you look at its success, the success of the CIA in covert action, and at some point here I want to talk about the very idea of these two functions and at the outset how much of these two things was the agency supposed to be doing. But let's set that aside for a second. I just say, as a covert action agency, how successful has the CIA been? How would you answer that?
Very few of the major covert operations of the CIA during the Cold War and afterwards were long-term successes. There were some short-term successes. If you consider the overthrow of the government of Guatemala in 1953 a success, they did what they set out to do. It was a chaotic scattershot operation, but they overthrew the legally elected president of Guatemala and installed a series of military leaders there. And that, in their view, and in the view of the president, President Eisenhower, stopped the advance of communism in the Western Hemisphere. The consequence, of course, was a series of military regimes and a civil war in which 200,000 civilians died over the next 40 years. That's not a success in the long term. You can consider the overthrow of the government of Iran in 1954 as a success. the duly elected leader of Iran, the Prime Minister Mossadegh, was overthrown, and the compliant, weak-willed Shah of Iran was installed, and he became the centerpiece of American foreign policy in the nations of Islam for the next 25 years. So we got 25 years of stability out of that. Unfortunately, every Iranian knew that the CIA had installed the Shah, and when his corruption and his heavy-handedness became too much to bear, there was a popular revolution, and we've had 28 years of instability as a consequence. So that, too, cannot be counted as a long-term success.
Hmm. How, then, if we ask this question, looking at everything that the CIA has done, if you assess its overall effectiveness, say, assign a letter grade to how successful the CIA has been overall, what would, and this is clearly here, this is not a matter of opinion, there is now a significant record to base such an assessment on. So, having said that, how would you grade overall the effectiveness of the CIA?
Well, I'm quite proud of the fact that Legacy of Ashes is entirely on the record. There are no blind quotes. There are no anonymous sources. It's all documented. It's 500 pages of text and 200 pages of notes and supporting documentation. So having said that, let's divide what the CIA does into three broad categories. Intelligence analysis, probably a low B, a B minus or C plus. The CIA was less wrong about Vietnam than any other branch of the American government. They warned as early as 1966 that this was a political war that was not going to be won by military means. And they eventually convinced President Johnson of that, and that's one major reason that Johnson didn't run for re-election. In 1968. The CIA also contributed to arms control by inventing the technologies and methodologies of analysis by which you could count the strength of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union didn't change very much over time. It was like a mountain as you look down from spy satellites. And so that helped keep the Cold War cold, and that can be counted as a major analytical success. Arms control is a process that is now largely forgotten, and treaties have been abrogated, but that helped. Espionage. That is the business of stealing secrets abroad, gathering secret information, finding out what's going on. Probably a low C, a C minus. We are not good at this as Americans, and there are some perfectly understandable reasons why. This is not a CIA problem. This is an American problem. Secrecy and deception are not our strong suits because we're Americans, but neither are foreign languages, foreign cultures, and foreign histories. We literally do not speak the language. And you can put up all the billion-dollar spy satellites you want to look down on a country. But the only way to know what's going on, the only way to know what another man thinks is to talk to him. And if you can't speak his language, you can't talk to him. So we wind up buying our intelligence from, quote, friendly, unquote, foreign intelligence services. And there are no friendly foreign intelligence services. Nations don't have friends. They have interests. So qualitatively, espionage, I would rank as probably a C minus. And covert action, and that is the business of the first two categories, analysis and espionage, are the business of trying to know the world. Covert action seeks to change the world, to change, to steal an election, to overthrow a government, to use political propaganda to affect public opinion abroad, to make or break political parties abroad. And constructively, nation building. The CIA was all about nation building in South Vietnam for many, many years. On the whole, covert action would get a D. Because we want, and I say presidents want, because ever since the Bay of Pigs debacle of 1961, the CIA has been exquisitely sensitive to presidential command and control. It does what it does because presidents tell it to do things. Covert action is a presidential tool. It is the pointed end of the spear of American foreign policy. There have been some short-term successes. We have created governments in third world countries. We have created secret police forces in third world countries. But the long-term effects have not been good. They have not lasted and, indeed, have not served American interests in the long run.
Let me here at this point very quickly introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Tim Weiner. He works for the New York Times and has written on American intelligence for 20 years. He's won the Pulitzer Prize for his work on secret national security programs. He's traveled all over the world, Afghanistan, other places, to investigate CIA covert operations firsthand, and has authored a number of books, including the newest, which is A History of the CIA. The title of the book is Legacy of Ashes, and it's published by Doubleday. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, given the fact that the overall effectiveness of the agency is not terribly good, worst at covert action, best at intelligence analysis, and even there you give it a low B grade, why is it that for such a long time people both in the United States and around the world believed that the CIA was so powerful and so effective?
The director of Central Intelligence during the Eisenhower years and briefly in the Kennedy years was Alan Dulles. He was the brother of the Secretary of State under Eisenhower, John Foster Dulles. And Alan Dulles believed, among other things, that dignified publicity was better than discreet silence. And he created a myth about the CIA, that it was a subtle, strong, and highly capable instrument that could change foreign governments by sleight of hand with abracadabra. It could change foreign governments, as we saw in Guatemala and Iran, but it did so by force, by dropping bombs, by creating riots, and by causing the deaths of the people whom it wanted to overthrow. But it didn't tell Dwight Eisenhower that, didn't tell the president that. For example, after Guatemala, Eisenhower called in the principal players of the Guatemala operation, which was codenamed Operation Success, to the White House, and he turned to the head of the paramilitary unit, a guy named Rip Robertson, and he said, "So, how many men did Castillo Armas lose?" Castillo Armas was the colonel that we were backing for power in Guatemala to overthrow the president. And the CIA man replied to the president, "Only one." "Incredible," said the president. "Well, it was, because, in fact, Castillo Armas had lost many, 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 many dead in battle, fully about a fifth of his several hundred-man force." This business of lying to presidents is a very dangerous, dangerous pursuit. Nobody corrected the record. And finally, during his second term, Dwight Eisenhower began to realize that he had been conned by Alan Dulles. And in the last week of his presidency, the same week that he gave that famous State of the Union speech warning about the military-industrial complex and the disastrous rise of misplaced power in this country, he held a full-dress meeting, President Eisenhower did, of the National Security Council. And he turned to Alan Dulles in front of everybody in his cabinet. He said, "Alan, I have been after you for 8 years to organize Central Intelligence, and you have failed me. You have handed me an 8-year defeat on this issue," said the president. "And I am going to hand to my successor, John F. Kennedy, a legacy of ashes." And 4 months later came the Bay of Pigs. Mm-hmm. And that was the end of the career of Alan Dulles.
I think here there's an important point to be made, because just recently, if you look at the whole debacle over weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, there certainly has been criticism for the CIA and for the guy who was the head at the time, Mr. Tenet, for telling President Bush what he, that is Mr. Tenet, thought President Bush wanted to hear.
Well, a great deal of nonsense has been written about this.
Yeah.
And in Legacy of Ashes, I lay out in black and white what happened. How was it that the CIA was able to report with a straight face in the fall of 2002 that Iraq was bristling with chemical and biological weapons and working on a nuclear bomb, when in fact those weapons didn't exist? The CIA had intelligence about those weapons, but unfortunately that intelligence was 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It came from the 1990s, when the United Nations had weapons inspectors combing Iraq, looking for these weapons. The CIA did not know that Saddam Hussein had destroyed those weapons in compliance with United Nations orders. Saddam Hussein wanted the United States and his neighbors, Iran and Israel, to think that he had these weapons as a means of deterrence so he wouldn't be attacked. But he didn't have them. The CIA's intelligence was old, it was stale, and it had been overtaken by events. It found a few defectors who corroborated this outdated information, and it presented its case to the President and to the Secretary of State and to the Secretary of Defense, who presented it to the world, and none of it was true.
So then what I hear you saying is that in this particular case, then, the CIA believed that the information that it was giving to the President was accurate.
That's correct.
I raise this particular point. Well, I'm glad that we've clarified it, but I guess I raise this particular point because it does seem to be the case that there have been number of examples in the past where the CIA and its director did indeed, was not straight with the President and did indeed tell the President what they thought the President wanted to hear.
It wasn't a matter of not being straight with the President. It was a matter of the President not wanting information that was at odds with his view of the world.
Hmm.
You know, Richard Nixon wanted to build an anti-ballistic missile defense. This is the precursor of Ronald Reagan's Star Wars and the current President Bush's own missile defense plans. This is going back to the late 1960s, early 1970s. And the CIA duly reported, correctly, that there was no evidence that the Soviet Union wanted to attack the United States with a devastating first strike of nuclear weapons, and therefore building an anti-ballistic missile defense was both technologically fantastic and probably not necessary. Well, Richard Nixon didn't want to hear that, and he hammered Richard Helms, the director of Central Intelligence, hard, until Helms finally threw up his hands and deleted a crucial paragraph from the CIA's estimate of Soviet forces to make the President happy. Was that intellectually dishonest? Yes. Was it politically necessary? Probably. These are the kinds of choices that presidents make, directors of Central Intelligence execute.
Do you think that part of the problem with the CIA was, from the very beginning, the idea that essentially the CIA answered only to one person, that person being the President of the United States?
No, I don't think so. I think that we found ourselves at the end of World War II as a superpower. We bestrode the world like a colossus, and we were, like it or not, the most powerful force on Earth. We needed to have an intelligence service. All nations that project power beyond their own borders have always had intelligence services, and we needed that service to be able to look over the horizon of the earth and to tell presidents what was going on abroad, particularly because Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union was a threat to the United States and was a threat to our allies. And, you know, it started out with the mission to know the world. But that mission quickly became to change the world and to foil the Soviet Union at every turn.
That, I think that this is a question I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about, because I think, as you point out in the book, that initially the main function here was supposed to be gathering intelligence, doing certainly the first function that you talked about, and perhaps using espionage to do that.
Absolutely.
And less so the idea of covert action. I think as you, the very first line here in your first chapter is that all Harry Truman wanted was a newspaper. He wanted information. He wanted data. How is it that we went from something that was primarily supposed to be about gathering information for the president, and eventually we get involved so much in covert action, where it seems to be the record is the worst?
The Cold War got hot very quickly. And in Western Europe, there were a number of challenges that the Soviet Union presented, and one was that there was going to be a free election in Italy in 1948, and the communists were quite strong at the ballot box. After all, you know, fascism had just been defeated, and the Red Army, Stalin's army, was rather crucial in the defeat of Adolf Hitler. And the CIA determined that if the communists won power through the ballot box, they would keep it. And then you had the specter of the Vatican being surrounded by communists. So, in its first major covert action, it went to try and help steal the Italian election for the center-right, the Christian Democrats, with satchels full of money. It worked. And political warfare, fighting fire with fire, became quite the vogue. But then the Korean War broke out. And that wasn't about stealing an election or electing a prime minister. Tens of thousands of American soldiers were dying. And the CIA, in desperation, recruited thousands of foreign agents. In the Korean theater of war, they were Koreans. They were Chinese nationalists. They were Vietnamese. And they put them into airplanes, and they strapped parachutes on their backs, and they flung them into darkness behind enemy lines to try and gather intelligence and to try and help run paramilitary operations. And they died. They died by the thousands. On a smaller scale, the same was done in Russia and behind the Iron Curtain in Eastern and Central Europe. Recruited foreign agents, Russians, Central Europeans, Poles, Hungarians, Balts, Slovaks, Czechs, were recruited, trained up in Munich, placed on airplanes, equipped with parachutes, flung out into darkness, and they never returned.
Let me ask one more question, and then we'll get to some calls here. We're already about midway through the conversation. And that is to talk about the quality of leadership at the head of the CIA. I think even if you were being charitable, you would have to say that a lot of the men who had been directors of CIA were disappointment, and one would have to say that some of them were incompetent would be a perfectly appropriate word.
Well, there have been some great men who have run CIA, and one was General Walter Beadle Smith, who ran it during the Korean War, and he had been Eisenhower's chief of staff during World War II. When Eisenhower was the supreme military commander in Europe. And the quality of generalship, Beadle Smith was a four-star general, is very important because the CIA is an organization with an essentially military ethos. And real generalship in this country is pretty hard to find these days. That's another conversation. A second great leader of the CIA, in my opinion, was John McCone. McCone was the very conservative California Republican whom President Kennedy appointed to replace Allen Dulles after the Bay of Pigs. McCone fought tooth and nail to make the CIA a professional intelligence service, and he is the secret hero of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was the only person in the American government who warned that the Soviets might want to put nuclear weapons into Cuba. The only one. The CIA, as an institution, thought this was a ridiculous idea. Well, McCone was right. And it was McCone who was instrumental in putting together the idea of a blockade rather than an invasion of Cuba that could have led to World War III. But there have been people who have been, if not uniquely ill-qualified, poorly qualified to run the CIA. As President Eisenhower said, it takes a strange kind of genius to run an organization like that.
Well, we are at our midpoint here. Our guest, again, Tim Weiner, he's a reporter for the New York Times, has written about American intelligence for a long time, has a new book out that is a history of the CIA. The title of his book is Legacy of Ashes, and it's published by Doubleday. We do have some callers here. We are now into our last 20, 25 minutes, so people will help us by being brief. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. But, of course, questions from people listening are welcome. We'll start here with Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for the twofer, having National Security Archives gentleman right after Tim Weiner. It was great. It needs a lot of attention. The history and the present, both, I would guess. I just heard a disturbing figure about contemporary CIA. Now, of course, there are 18 other intelligence gathering units, and there's this move to privatization that is something that contemporarily should be discussed. But that 50% of CIA analysts are now have less than 5 years experience, and there's even a lot of turnover inside that. This outsourcing is extremely disturbing because there's already all these mixed motives in shaping analysis. The having private companies like SAIC and other companies is extremely distressing, I think, for a really openness and democracy. I wanted to get back to the historical record somewhat, and I'm wondering how you look at the few dissident CIA people who have gone public, like Ralph McGehee and John Stockwell. Phil Agee is probably the most notorious, particularly after the Plem outing and the legislation that was crafted to go after him particularly. Stockwell, I'm thinking of one of the ways of covert action is really disinformation, and he claims that he personally, he was an Angola CIA station chief, that he personally put a story in the press in Africa that then got picked up by the world. He calls it the Mighty Wurlitzer, where he feels like he has a lot of control over the stories by starting stories in the third world press. And the story that he, one particular one that was made out of whole cloth, was that the this was at the time of the other covert war and the Clark Amendment and the Bolin Amendment are parallel. In Angola, the Cubans were fighting the South Africans in Angola and on the frontline states. And he initiated a story in the press there that some Angolan women had been raped by Cuban troops and that the death penalty had been put on them, and that the women themselves had gotten to shoot their own supposed rapists. Now, it was totally concocted. It was designed to discredit the opposition by Cuba and others to the South African government at that time. It was trumpeted around the world. I don't know how much an impact it had in Africa, because people probably knew. Some people didn't know that. But the whole idea of that covert action isn't just, you know, poisoning people, sticking them with poison umbrellas or something. It's also this disinformation that is extremely pernicious, because it goes into shaping attitudes back here in
Right. And in the Cold War, we as a nation could justify doing this because the Soviets did it. You know, the Soviet KGB was 10 times the size of the CIA, far more brutal, and far more willing to use the tricks of the trade in a crude way, such as disinformation, such as the story that, you know, AIDS was an invention of a mad American government scientist, things like that. The tools are very powerful in covert action, and the controls on them should be close to as strict as the controls on the release of nuclear weapons, because they have fallout. The fallout blows back, and it can spread from the target area to unintended places.
The blowback is the important word, and I'm sure Chalmers Johnson influenced you, but you know, this goes back to the beginning of the CIA and the recruitment of the Galen organization, the Nazis who had just been defeated. It seems that it was poisoned at its inception in a large way.
You have to understand the mindset of the men who ran the CIA in the Cold War, in the 50s and the 60s, in the 70s. It was to fight fire with fire. And if the Soviets did it, we were going to do it too. We were going to go belly to belly with them in every country on Earth, and where they pushed, we would push back.
Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the caller, and I want to go on to somebody else here in the nearby community of Belgium, not all that far away. Thus is our line number 4. Hello.
Yes. In your discussion about the CIA, I can't help but think you need to say something about NSA also. People who are very, very secretive and may very well do their job well, but their information leads to a lot of these things you're talking about. Thank you very much.
All right. Yeah, I'm interested also in the same issue, and particularly if you anything you can say about the comparing the effectiveness of CIA, NSA, and certainly there are other intelligence gathering units.
Yes.
that are part of the government as well.
Until very recently, the CIA was first among equals. It is no longer first among equals in the American intelligence community. It's been demoted. The NSA is much larger than CIA. It is a military organization. It is based at Fort Meade, Maryland, midway between Baltimore and Washington. And it operates global electronic eavesdropping technology. 15 years ago, maybe as recently as 10 years ago, the NSA was probably 10 years ahead of the technological curve in the public domain. Today, it is 10 years behind the curve. And the reason for this is the proliferation of cell phones, of email, and of publicly available encryption, that is, the encoding of computer messages. The NSA is quite literally drowning under the incredible flood of information technology, and its own information technology is cracking under the strain. Nevertheless, they are able to monitor. That doesn't mean read and analyze. That's a different issue. They are able to monitor many millions of telecommunications around the world. Now, how much of that gets actually read and analyzed? Probably 1%. It's like trying to get a drink of water from a fire hose.
Hmm. One of the things that has happened since September 11th of 2001 is this reorganization of intelligence and taking all of these various agencies, different agencies, and putting them under one big umbrella under this person that we now call Director of National Intelligence.
Just another layer of bureaucracy.
Well, the idea was that
another set of boxes, another set of wiring diagrams. It doesn't get to the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem is people. There has always been a lack of talent at CIA. It takes dedication and it takes expertise to do this kind of work. Now, as the caller before mentioned, we today have the least experienced and least talented CIA workforce in the 60-year history of the CIA. Half of them have less than 5 years' experience, and by the CIA's own standards, they are trainees. They are not good to go. This is a huge problem. This is an American problem, not a CIA problem. And the consequence has been outsourcing. Money is not a problem there now, not after 9/11. Because the CIA is incapable of doing many of the missions assigned to it, it is delegating these missions to companies like Lockheed Martin and 100 different corporate clones of the CIA that have sprung up like mushrooms on the periphery of the Beltway outside of Washington. This is not an inherently evil thing. If the job can get done and the job is trying to understand the world, more power to them. But at the end of the day, these people work for Lockheed Martin. not the United States government.
Let's talk with another caller here in Urbana, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I just wanted to say I'm partway through your book, and it's really good. I really am enjoying it. I had a question. I think an interview you had done on C-SPAN a couple of weeks ago, and at the conclusion of that, you mentioned that people should, you know, maybe learn more about the enemy, you know, knowing their language, you know, for example, Arabic, Farsi, Korean, and Chinese. My question was, do you think the CIA has enough resources they're devoting to understanding the Chinese?
Absolutely not. There is a program that was set up at the end of the Cold War called the National Security Education Program. And this program awards scholarships to undergraduates and graduate students to learn those tough languages, Arabic, Chinese, Farsi, Urdu, you know, the languages that pull down your grade point average and that take 5 years to become, you know, moderately fluent in. This program is funded by the Congress for the grand total of $4 million. If I ran the circus, I would add three zeros to that and finance it at $4 billion a year for the next 5 years and go to 18-year-olds, to high school seniors, and say, how would you like to learn Arabic and Chinese and other languages? Just choose one. And also about the history and the culture of the countries where those languages are spoken. And we'll pay your way. And at the end of 5 years, you would probably have, this is a guesstimate, 100,000 fluent people. It's 100,000 more than we have right now. maybe 1 in 10 of those would want to serve their country in interesting ways. As a diplomat, there's a crying need for people in the American Foreign Service. They have 1,000 positions in the State Department that they can't fill. Or as soldiers, or as spies. That's where it begins, in my opinion. History, culture, language. We've got to get good at this.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Others are welcome. We have about 10 minutes left with our guest, Tim Weiner. He's a reporter for the New York Times, author of a new history of the CIA. The title of his book is Legacy of Ashes. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. How would you assess the quality of oversight of CIA activities that has been done by the Congress, and is here again the problem that to do that oversight, Congress would have to be provided with information by the agency, and the agency is not likely to deliver up information that's going to make it look bad.
Sadly, Congress has done a terrible job at this. There are no particular incentives for Congress to do this work. It doesn't bring the bacon back home. It doesn't build highways or bridges or there's no money in it. Mm-hmm. So it takes dedication and sacrifice of time by members of Congress. And certainly from 9/11 until this new Congress was sworn in this past January, there was virtually no oversight. It was a shocking abdication of congressional responsibility. It just didn't do the job. And that is because I think that the executive branch didn't want it done.
Hmm. Well, let's go to another caller here. We have someone over in Bloomington, Illinois, this time around, on our toll, or not our toll free line, but our line number one here. Line one, it's callers right here. Hello.
Hello. Just a very quick question. Could you talk about the relationship between the CIA and the FBI, which, if either, is better in dealing with this phenomenon we call terrorism? I'll listen offline. Thank you.
All right.
The almost completely dysfunctional relationship between the CIA and the FBI has been a problem ever since the CIA's creation. J. Edgar Hoover, who ran the FBI from 1924 to 1972 was bitterly opposed to the creation of the CIA and did not cooperate. They did not play well together. They did not share information. And in the FBI's case, their information technologies are so bad and were so crushingly bad in the 1990s that they probably couldn't have shared information if they wanted to. And one of the proximate causes of 9/11 was the inability of the CIA and the FBI to share information, to connect the dots. Had they done the minimum that was called of them in terms of sharing information, at least two of the hijackers would have been intercepted and the plot could have been uncovered. The history of this relationship is truly dreadful. Their backstabbing, their subversion of one another, and worse, their claim to the public and the American people that everything was hunky-dory in their relationship, which they made repeatedly in the late 1990s, that wasn't true. One of the most important jobs that confront the American government right now is how to make these two very different agencies, their cultures are different, their methodologies are different, their mission is completely different. You do not want your Foreign Intelligence Service, the CIA, spying inside your borders. That was the greatest fear of Harry Truman when he created the CIA, that it would become an American Gestapo, his words. You do want your FBI to be spying inside your borders, to be arresting criminals, to be arresting plotters, and you want these two people to cooperate at the seam of their responsibilities where they interface, and that is the border of the United States. The American homeland also includes American embassies overseas and American forward military bases overseas. And so these two agencies also have to cooperate with the State Department and with the Pentagon in order to protect American lives.
Let's talk again with another caller. This is someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yes. I so appreciated your comment about learning the languages and the cultures. I'm an anthropologist, and when we spend a lifetime studying one country, well, sometimes more than one, but usually one, and we learn the language and we teach the culture, we learn the culture, we interact with people from the culture. When I first did field work in Southeast Asia in the late 1950s, long time ago, one of the things I came back with after meeting Foreign Service people was the fact that they didn't know the culture and they didn't know the language. And I lectured about this in the late 1950s, and I wonder if there's something endemic about the American system by which we don't do this. I mean, it's hard for me to understand it.
We're Americans. And by the way, cultural anthropologists and foreign intelligence officers have a lot in common in their methodologies.
Right.
We're Americans. We want everybody to speak like us and to think like us and to be like us, and we get mad when they don't. Everyone who's traveled abroad as a tourist in a foreign country has seen the spectacle of an American trying to communicate in English with someone who doesn't speak English, and they just talk louder, right?
Right.
And this is a problem we need to solve. And if we do not solve it, my guess is that we will not endure as a superpower for too many more generations.
How do you think we should solve it? What are the steps?
Well, I would finance on a grand scale, a multi-billion-dollar scale, the education of undergraduates in Chinese, Arabic, Urdu, Pashto, Farsi, tough languages, take 5 years to get up to speed, and I would call upon the American government to finance that in a five-year program that would create 100,000 fluent people. That's where I would begin.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Again, I want to thank the last caller and go and try to include at least one more. We'll go next to Champagne. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about James Jesus Angleton. My understanding is that for many years he was the head of counterintelligence for the CIA, and there's sort of this picture of him as being an incredibly paranoid individual who thought that essentially every defector was a plant from the Soviet Union. What was he like, and what effect did he have on the CIA? Thanks.
Yeah, the middle name was Jesus, by the way.
Oh, Jesus, okay.
He didn't use it. He was embarrassed by it. Jim Angleton was a charter member of the CIA, and from 1954 to 1974, the chief of the counterintelligence staff. And it was his belief that the Soviet Union was engaged in a master plot to deceive the United States, and that it sent false defectors to the United States to mystify and mislead and surprise us, and that only his counterintelligence staff could understand the machinations of this master plot, or as it came to be known at the CIA, the monster plot. Now, on the positive side, the CIA was not penetrated in a major way by a Soviet spy. So far as we know, during Angleton's tenure. On the negative side, Angleton paralyzed the operations of the Soviet division of the CIA, wrapping them up in his labyrinthine conspiracy theories, and essentially froze them in place for the better part of 15 years. He was a very difficult man.
You know, through the work of journalists like you, and certainly there have been others, and as a former caller mentioned, some people who have been in the agency have written about its experiences. A lot of people have worked to produce a record of CIA activity over the years, the things that the agency did that it tried to keep secret. And having said that, and now that there is a substantial public record, would you say that there are still things, aspects of the CIA and its operations over the last however many years the agency, 60 years or so the agency has been around, that we still don't know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, by writing this book on the record, I've been able to put in a chronological form not only the history of the CIA, but the history of the United States as a foreign power, as it projects power around the world, because the CIA is simply the pointed end of the spear of American foreign policy. It is part of the United States government, including the Pentagon and the State Department and the White House, that projects our power overseas. We have to get better at this. I am not one of these people who says, well, my God, the CIA, just burn it to the ground and sow salt in the ashes and have done with it. Quite the opposite. I think we have to get good at this. I think that it is a matter of our national survival that we get good at this and that we understand how other countries work, how other people think, and get on top of an increasingly dangerous situation that confronts us not only in the Middle East, but in Asia and in Africa and in the Western Hemisphere, in Latin America. People love the United States because of our freedoms. People want to come here and become Americans because of the beauty of our Constitution and our Bill of Rights and because of the opportunities that we provide. If people start to hate us, not because of our freedoms, but because of the way we use power in the world, that will be a terrible turn of events for this country. So we want to use our power wisely. And the CIA, if well-run and well-staffed, and in my opinion that will take another generation, could be an instrument for good, for the projection of American power in constructive ways in this world. And I think that would be a very good thing, and that is my belief as an American citizen.
Well, in that, we have talked about the challenge of rebuilding what is a much diminished agency and talked about the problem of needing expertise that perhaps doesn't exist. How optimistic are you that the CIA could become the agency that this country needs.
That would take new leadership in the White House and new leadership in Congress.
Well, I certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. I think it's an important piece of reporting, and if people are interested in learning more about the history of the CIA, you can certainly look for the book that we've talked about. The title, again, is Legacy of Ashes. The publisher is Doubleday, and the author is our guest, Tim Weiner. He's a reporter for The New York Times. And, Mr. Weiner, thanks very much.
It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.